content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Smithsonian. And this falls under the headline Smart News, keeping you current. 12 facts about the 12 days of Christmas. Amaze and astound your loved ones with these pieces of carol trivia by Kat Eschner. You might be getting tired of Christmas carols. Here are 12 things to know about a Christmas classic. The earliest printed version of this poem that researchers know of dates back to 1780 and the book Mirth Without Mischief. In that version, it was a chant or a poem that wasn't set to music. It was originally a kind of poem known as cumulative verse. This Christmas classic would be well suited, being a chant or poem. It's written in a poetic form called cumulative verse, where each patterned verse contributes to a longer narrative. If you want another example, think there was an old lady who swallowed a fly. Rhymed verse may have originated in dancing and singing, cumulative verse in resuscitation and instruction, writes Lena Echtenstein in Comparative Studies in Nursery Rhymes. So far, let's see where we're going with this. Some believe that it was created to teach Catholic children the catechism in a coded way, but it probably wasn't. This structure, along with other facets of the song, has caused some to believe that the rhyme was a way for British Catholics to subversively teach Catholic children the catechism, because their religion was controversial in 1700s England. However, writes David Mickelson for Snopes, this theory only appeared in the 1990s, and it isn't supported by any documentary evidence, meaning it's deeply unlikely this link authentically exists. So where are we going with this? There are really 12 days of Christmas. Furthermore, Mickelson writes, there was absolutely no reason why any Catholic would have to hide his knowledge of any of the concepts supposedly symbolized in the 12 days of Christmas, because these were basic articles of faith common to all denominations of Christianity. These tenets weren't directly linked to any celebration of the 12 days of Christmas, which actually began on December 25 and end on the 12th day, that is January 5, also known as the Feast of the Epiphany. The poem is, in some form, likely much older than 1780. Like the 12-day celebration of Christmas itself, writes Tanya Pei for Vox, the 12 days of Christmas likely has roots that well predate 1780. It may have been French in origin, she writes. A Scottish holiday poem is very similar. This theory is backed up by the fact that other poems about the 12 days of Christmas do exist, such as Scottish poem The Yule Days. This poem includes a king sending his lady, partridges, geese, ducks, swans, the list goes on, just like the English poem. Its origins probably relate to a memory game. Although the exact origins of the song are unknown, it is highly probable that it began as a memory and forfeit game for Twelfth Night celebrations, which would have been said and not sung, write authors Mark Lawson-Jones and Dominic Walker. The players gathered in a circle, and the leader would recite a verse. Each would repeat it. The leader would add another verse and speak faster, and so on, until a mistake was made by one of the players, who would then drop out of the game. The last player standing was the winner. Some versions contain bloody things we'd now consider animal abuse, but were seen as entertainment. Even in English, there are a number of different, less well-known variants of the lyrics. These range from the relatively innocent ships a-sailing instead of pipers piping, to lyrics that reflect earlier times' attitudes toward animals. For instance, bears abating or badgers baiting, which refers to the practice of getting these animals to fight with dogs. This form of entertainment was relatively common during periods of celebration. Some people think the animal references relate to feasting, and Europeans did actually used to eat most of the animals mentioned. There are a number of animals mentioned in all versions of the song, and many of them are things Europeans would have eaten, leading many to interpret the animal sections as relating to feasting, writes Olga Kazan for The Atlantic. That means that partridge in a pear tree wasn't just for the holiday decorations. It wasn't set to music until the 20th century. The tune of this now familiar Christmas carol only dates back to the early 20th century when it was composed by Frederick Austin. It's based on a traditional folk song, but both the lyrics and the melody were altered by the composer. Giving someone all the gifts in the song would be expensive. It's pretty unlikely that anyone ever received all of the gifts proposed in the song. If so, however, they would have been costly, writes Pei. Today, if someone wished to replicate the list, they'd be looking at more than $30,000. It has been parodied numerous times. Like most Christmas carols, Jingle Bells, anyone? The 12 Days of Christmas has been parodied on numerous occasions, from comedian and Las Vegas performer Faye McKay's boozy version, The 12 Days, D-A-Z-E, of Christmas. You'll find a parody out there to suit every festive mood. Kat Eschner is a freelance science and culture journalist based in Toronto. Up next, The Real Man Who Inspired Ebenezer Scrooge by Benito Cereno. Charles Dickens' 1843 book, A Christmas Carol, is one of the best known and best loved holiday stories of all time, credited with everything from popularizing the phrase Merry Christmas to even making Christmas the popular holiday it is today, following earlier suppression of the holiday in England by the Puritans. Remember that movie, The Man Who Invented Christmas? That's what that title is getting at. A big part of the success of A Christmas Carol comes from the vivid portrayal and dramatic character arc of its central figure, Ebenezer Scrooge. Scrooge has become an unquestionable icon of Christmas, portrayed on screens big and small by such formidable actors as Alastair Sim, George C. Scott, Michael Caine, Patrick Stewart, and Jim Carrey. And, of course, his namesake, Scrooge McDuck, who carries on the tradition of thrift despite great wealth. But where did Scrooge come from? Where, Charles Dickens, do you get your ideas? The Man Who Invented Christmas posits that Dickens based Scrooge on his own father. While that's certainly within the realm of possibility, Dickens' father is more widely acknowledged as the inspiration for the character Mr. Micawber and the semi-autobiographical David Copperfield. And there are a couple of other stronger candidates that have been suggested over the years for Scrooge. But who, then, is the man behind the miser? While there are many different men that modern fans claim to be the inspiration for Scrooge, some of them championed by the citizens of these men's hometowns, hoping to drum up some tourism dollars, a shameless cash grab that Scrooge would no doubt approve of, the most likely candidate is an 18th century British politician named John Eales, who was notorious for his penny pinching. Supporting the idea that Eales was the model for Dickens' most famous miser is the fact that we know for sure that Dickens knew of Eales, despite the latter dying years before Dickens was born. Dickens mentions elves and his parsimonious habits in his letters, as well as referencing him in his last complete novel, Our Mutual Friend. Dickens wasn't the only one, either. William Harrison Ainsworth is believed to have based his character, John Scarf, the titular miser from his novel, The Miser's Daughter, on elves as well. John Elves was born John Meggett in 1714 and inherited his first fortune, worth about $10 million today, at just 4 years of age, following the passing of his father, a brewer. But he really struck it rich after spending his life imitating and sucking up to his uncle, Sir Hervé Elves, a wealthy member of Parliament and himself an infamous miser. Meggett changed his name to Elves to curry his uncle's favor, and he found himself the recipient of an estate worth roughly $23 million today. But if, as they say, a penny saved is a penny earned, John Elves was more like a billionaire. The young Elves learned much of his miserly mindset from his uncle, though his mother, who reportedly starved to death because she refused to buy food despite being rich, probably played a role as well. With whom would he sit around complaining about the way other people wasted money while sharing a single glass of wine between them? Elves took these lessons to heart and took thrift to a comical extreme. For example, Dickens said of his literary miser that darkness is cheap, and Scrooge liked it, and Elves thought the same way. He would always go to bed as soon as the sun set, so he wouldn't have to pay for candles. He ate roadkill, including a bird that a rat pulled from a river, and would eat moldy and rotting food rather than let it go to waste. He wore ragged clothes, including a wig he found in a bush that looked, well, his look was so busted that strangers often assumed he was a beggar and would drop pennies in his hand. He would walk in the rain rather than paying for a coach, and then he would sit around in his wet clothes rather than waste fuel building a fire to dry them. His roof leaked, and his lavish home fell to ruin around him. He got mad at birds who stole hay from his fields to build their nests. These all sound like jokes, but this is just what the dude was like. The Politics of Parsimony. This might be the wildest Elves story of them all. Actually, Elves once cut both of his legs badly while walking home in the dark. Of course. Being distrustful of doctors, he would only let the apothecary treat one leg, setting out a wager. If his untreated leg healed faster than the treated one, the apothecary would forfeit his fee. As it happens, the untreated leg healed 2 weeks faster, and presumably Elves was as smug as some kind of 18th century anti-vaxxer. Anyway, like his grandfather and uncle before him, Elves ran for Parliament and served 3 terms. He was technically a member of the Whig Party, but he would vote for whichever party's policy seemed most frugal. Other members of Parliament joked that they would have called him a turncoat, but they knew for a fact that he only owned 1 coat. He would travel to Parliament by the long route to avoid toll roads. He would ride his underfed horse to work, stopping along the way to eat a hard-boiled egg he kept in his pocket and take a nap under some bushes. After a total of 12 years in Parliament, he decided to retire rather than to continuing to pour out money in running for public office. Considering his election expenses were a staggering 18 pence, less than $2 in today's money, probably, British money from history times is weird. It's no surprise he'd want to relieve himself of that burden. If you look at Elves' life more closely, however, the Scrooge comparisons start to fall away. once you get past extreme personal frugality. When it came to other people, it turns out, John Els could be generous with his money. When his friends were in dire financial straits, he would be generous to a fault with his assistants. Furthermore, while he would lend money freely, he was too polite to ever ask his friends to repay him. One story says he once lent a friend £7,000, unprompted, so the friend could bet on a horse race. Els himself showed up at the racetrack with nothing to eat for the whole day but a 2-month-old pancake he found in his coat pocket that he swore was as good as new. Els also spent a lot of money in investments, some bad, many good. Most notably, he was a patron of architect Robert Adam, and as such financed a lot of London's West End architecture, including Portman Square and parts of Oxford Circus, Piccadilly, Baker Street, and Marylebone. So if you've ever enjoyed any of those places, you can thank the generosity of England's most famous non-fiction miser. There are those, however, who argue that John Els is not the inspiration, or at least not the only inspiration, for Scrooge. Those people will point toward one Jeremy Wood, the owner of the Gloucester Old Bank and possibly Britain's first millionaire, known in his lifetime as the Gloucester Miser. He, like Els, was definitely known to Dickens, as the author. Also mentions him in Our Mutual Friend. Additionally, there is a character called Dismal Jimmy in the Pickwick Papers, and a court case in Bleak House is believed to have been inspired by legal battles over Wood's will that ran so long they ended up consuming most of his estate. Famous tales of Wood's parsimony include his visiting the docks in order to fill his pockets with coal that fell off boats being unloaded there, and that he walked everywhere instead of ever taking a carriage. Like Els, he would wear the same clothes for years until they became ragged. One story says a fellow traveler refused to believe that the raggedy Wood had any money in the bank, and so Wood bet him he could withdraw £100,000 when they got to the city. When Wood was able to procure such fat stacks, the incredulous traveler was forced to hand over his £5. Another story says he once hitchhiked to town in a hearse, riding in the back where the body was supposed to lie. Yes, they're legends, but rich people are wild, honestly. A Dickensian host. Yet another story of Dickens' inspiration for his famous miser comes from a legend so widespread that even the BBC reported it as a possibility. The story goes that Dickens was walking through a graveyard in Edinburgh and came across a tombstone that belonged to one Ebenezer Lennox Scrooge. The inscription underneath read that Scrooge was a mealman, that is, he sold corn. But Dickens misread it as a mean man, and his imagination was sparked by wondering just how stingy someone would have to be. Mean here meaning cheap, for this to be the way they would be remembered through eternity. The story then goes on to say that the real Scrooge was in fact a jolly bon vivant who had a reputation as a party animal, who once goosed a countess in church and birthed illegitimate children with his servants. Alas and alack, the story goes, this incredibly very real tombstone from an absolutely non-fictional person who actually existed, super coincidentally, was destroyed when the Edinburgh graveyard in question was being restored in the 1930s. But yes, real people very definitely intend to build a memorial in its place any day now. As the Telegraph points out, this popular story is almost certainly a hoax. The only source for this story is the man who originally told it in 1997, and there is no corroborating evidence whatsoever. He'll probably laugh himself into his own grave if that memorial to Scrooge ever gets built. Scrooge has more characteristics than just his miserliness. However, he is also cruel and antipathetic to the poor in an extreme degree. When, at the beginning of A Christmas Carol, he is asked if he might donate to aid the poor, Scrooge asks angrily, "Are there no prisons? And the union workhouses? The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigor then." When the collectors respond that not everyone can go to these places and many would rather die than go, Scrooge replies, if they would rather die, they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. For some critics, including this piece from Forbes, that phrase, surplus population, is a sure sign that Dickens' portrayal of Scrooge was a commentary on the still current, then and now, to be completely honest about it, debate around the philosophies of political economist Thomas Malthus. Malthus argued that economies and populations grow at different rates, and as a result, poverty is inevitable. The only solution in Malthusian thought is to limit population growth, which leads into some incredibly not at all terrible ideas like eugenics and what have you. Scrooge later feels shame at his early old Malthusian ideas when the ghost of Christmas present refers to Tiny Tim as surplus population. This ghost, with his cornucopia, a symbol of plenty, stands as a stark repudiation of Malthusian ideas. There is, he says, enough for everyone. You just have to share it. Fortunately, this is a concept Scrooge comes around to after a vision of himself becoming surplus. While there are certainly compelling arguments to be made that Dickens was inspired to create Scrooge by real-life misers and cruel philosophers, it can also be argued that Ebenezer Scrooge was simply the logical culmination of the development of certain ideas Dickens had already introduced in characters in some of his earlier works. For example, in Martin Chuzzlewit, written in serialized form between 1842 and 1844, during which period Dickens would have written A Christmas Carol. There is a rich old man named Martin Chuzzlewit who is paranoid about his fortune, fearing that his family has designs on his money. He's right. He adopts an orphan to be his caretaker with the understanding that he will take care of her financially as long as she tends to his health. When old Martin's grandson, also named Martin, falls in love with his grandfather's caretaker, the old man is furious, and this kind of inciting incident for all of young Martin's adventures and personal growth. Anyway, not to spoil a 170-plus-year-old book, but old Martin is revealed to actually be good and kind at the end of the book, in a character shift that prefigures Scrooge's own elevation. More to the point, in an earlier Christmas story that appeared in the Pickwick Papers some 7 years before A Christmas Carol, called The Story of the Goblins Who Stole a Sexton, a Christmas-hating grave digger named Gabriel Grubb is kidnapped by goblins who show him what Christmas is all about. Charles Dickens is famous for giving his characters colorful, memorable, and descriptive names. Many of these are meant to reveal something about the characters. Well, characters such as Wilkins Micawber from David Copperfield, Mr. Sowerberry from Oliver Twist, Canon Crisparkle from The Mystery of Edwin Drood, and the ultra-subtle Mr. Chokum Child from Hard Times. Ebenezer Scrooge is one such name where even the sound of it evokes a not particularly pleasant person. But might there be a significance behind the name beyond just the sound of it? Ebenezer is a biblical word appearing in 1 Samuel 7:12. But there it is, a stone set up by the prophet Samuel to commemorate the help that God gave the Israelites in their victory over the Philistines. Ebenezer is an anglicization of the Hebrew Eben Ha-Ezer, meaning stone of help. Today, if the word is used in a non-Scrooge context, it usually means any kind of remembrance of God's help, as in, "Here I raise mine Ebenezer," from the hymn, "Come Thou Font of Every Blessing." While arguably a stretch, Dickens' Ebenezer definitely receives divine help in overcoming his worst impulses. Similarly, Scrooge might be taken on the word scrowge, meaning to squeeze, recalling Dickens' description of Scrooge as a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. Likewise, Scrooge sounds like screw, which was an old British slang word for a miser. An alternative theory worth entertaining is that Ebenezer Scrooge just sounded good, so he went with it. They can't all be an chicken stalker. Although A Christmas Carol is definitely Dickens' most famous Christmas story, and indeed probably the most famous Christmas story not found in the Bible, it's certainly not his only one. He would go on to write several more, occasionally trying to catch that Scrooge lightning in a bottle again. Besides the earlier, the story of the goblins who stole a sexton, which was almost a draft for A Christmas Carol in a lot of ways, in 1844, the year after Carol came The Chimes, a story in which elderly messenger Trotty Veck is shamed by goblins for losing faith in the goodness of humanity and their capacity for self-improvement. That's going to wrap up this year for Smithsonian. We hope you've enjoyed today's reading. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next year. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.